You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
That has led to the whole cry of racism, because not only do you see people who are supporting, or many of Trump's supporters are kind of known racist, and I agree with the point that just because they support you doesn't mean you support them back, but then you have Trump giving that clue. That is somewhat disturbing.
Yeah, that's exactly why it disturbed me. Look, I know Donald Trump. He's not a racist. He's just not. I wouldn't support him if he was, but beyond that, you know, if you know him, you just know that he's not, in a way that's very hard to spell out in a way to people who don't know him. You kind of know among your friends and among the people you know who secretly harbors hatred in their heart, and he doesn't.
Do you mind if I ask you just stupid questions about politics for a little bit? I've seen criticisms where people say, okay, there was Trump the candidate, and now we're supposed to believe that Trump the president's going to be a lot different. Where do you think there's going to be the biggest disconnect between what he said before the election and what happens afterwards? All right, so I'm here with Ken Kersen, editor-in-chief of the New York Observer. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Just even being back here as a returning guest, I feel like David Brenner on The Tonight Show to come back twice.
And to be fair, you were here 2.5 years ago. I feel like it feels like yesterday, but I've been doing this podcast for a long time now. You were one of my first guests.
This podcast has grown tremendously. I barely knew what a podcast was the first time I was on. And now podcasts are huge. And this podcast in particular is one to which a lot of aspiring podcasters cite as an example.
Well, thank you for saying so. And you're on for a very important reason today, in addition to being a friend of the show. And by the way, also, your brother has been on the show, Robert Kersen, when he wrote his last book, was such an excellent book, and he was a great guest here as well. But I wanted to talk to you about an issue that's pressing the nation, of course. It actually, I've never seen any one topic other than 9/11 hog the news cycle so much as Donald Trump getting elected president. And of course, you've been ground zero on this. Back in April, you wrote one of the first editorials, where a newspaper endorsed Donald Trump. And of course, you took a lot of heat and a lot of controversy. And so I want to ask you about that. I want to ask you more about Trump. But I want to do you mind if I ask you just stupid questions about politics for a little bit?
James, you can ask me anything you like.
So you've been a campaign manager for Rudy Giuliani. I've been very apolitical. I've even written articles that they should abolish the presidency. So I'm totally naive about politics and everything. But this is naive question number one. And then I want to ask what you think Trump will do in his 4 or 8 years or whatever. But naive question number one is, why do newspapers, we generally think of them as supposed to be unbiased and, you know, fact-driven and news-driven, why do they endorse candidates for political office at all, president or even city council? Why does a newspaper endorse a candidate?
Well, that's traditionally been the reason newspapers exist, is to have a point of view.
I didn't know that, to be honest.
Yeah,
that's why this is a naive question.
The objectivity you describe, there is supposed to be, in an ideal world, there is a separation between the news gathering, the reporting, and the opinion, which takes place both in unsigned editorials, which represent the publisher's point of view, and in signed editorials that usually appear on the opposite page and are thus called op-eds, and letters to the editor and stuff like that. That all occurs in the opinion section. That's supposed to be separated from the straight reporting. It would be my contention that that's always been mostly a fiction. There has always, you know, people are human beings, and reporters bring their own biases to their reporting, and those biases seep into their quote unquote objective reporting. I'm making air quotes, but your listeners can't see me drawing those with my hands. And on the other hand, a good editorial should not just be somebody's opinion as he sits on his couch, but he ought to be a talented enough reporter to gather facts and do some reporting to inform his opinion. So these things are not as pure. They never have been as pure, and I don't think they ought to be. I think that you consume the news from other human beings. You consume it from a variety of sources, and it's a good thing if the news is informed by someone's judgment. What I do think is important is that you disclose to the best of your ability where those biases might be coming from. So my paper, for example, which is published by Jared Kushner, who is the son-in-law of Donald Trump, we disclose anytime we mention Donald Trump positively or negatively, we disclose that this relationship, and people can read it and go, well, I don't believe this at all because it's the son-in-law, or they can say, okay, they've told me what it's about, and I'll try and pay attention to the facts.
And to be fair, like I've noticed recently, the paper actually has been has reported both negative and positive things about Donald Trump, particularly since I think initially you got some heat for your support of Trump and even for your involvement in your slight involvement in the campaign. Like you helped write one of the speeches. You were at the Republican National Convention with the Trump family. And I've seen since then articles on both sides of kind of the Trump candidacy and then election since then. I guess, was that strategic? Must have been.
We always reported both sides on Trump. That's a fiction that only happened in reaction to something. In fact, we broke some stories that were hurtful to the Trump campaign. Like our reporter Will Bretterman broke the story that the Trump campaign's New York State chair had questioned whether the president is a Muslim, which was very harmful, you know, in this effort to cast aside some of these sort of, you know, birther stuff. We ran very tough editorials and opinion pieces against Donald Trump. Our columnist, John Reinisch, who is a Democratic operative, wrote some searing anti-Trump columns. And then we ran what might be the most famous anti-Trump opinion column of the entire election when our staffer, Dana Schwartz, wrote an open letter saying that the campaign, including our publisher, was ignoring dog whistles to anti-Semites. So the entire time we ran very tough stuff. But what makes us different is we also ran positive stuff, and that's what, you know, virtually every paper in the United States either treated this candidacy like a total joke. You had like the Huffington Post, for example, putting in the entertainment section or running this absolutely ridiculous and stupid and embarrassing disclaimer at the end saying, you know, this guy's a carnival barker or whatever they said. They had some really over-the-top, hilarious insider language of the variety I despise. So the fact that we were taking his candidacy seriously and covering it as news organizations should have been from both sides is to our credit, not to our detriment.
It seems like Trump is the first candidate ever to kind of skip the media process and go straight to the people. Like he went, like his Twitter feed, of course, blew up while he was running, and the guy was tweeting at 3 a.m. and people say it was maybe sometimes irresponsibly, but I do give him credit for trying to go directly to people as opposed to talking to people through reporters.
Well, you're right to give him credit. He deserves credit for it. I think that what you had here is a really stark dynamic of a candidate who, while arguably undisciplined, was clearly operating his own, you know, expressing his own thoughts. When somebody tweets at 3 or 4 a.m., filled with misspellings and stuff, you can complain about what he tweets, but there's no doubt that you're getting the authentic opinions of the guy who will lead the country. On the other hand, you had this very experienced, extremely polished, and to many, over-managed candidate who didn't give a news conference for, you know, a couple hundred days, and it was almost impossible to imagine Hillary Clinton saying something that wasn't rehearsed and poll tested and screened through a bunch of campaign professionals.
So let me ask you about two of the things you just said. One is, you know, wakes up at 3 a.m. and potentially puts these undisciplined tweets out there. Do we want a president who could potentially be undisciplined at 3 a.m?
Yeah, that 3 a.m. campaign ad that Hillary Clinton ran against Barack Obama is what you're referring to, and I think it's fair to ask that.
But I'm also referring to Trump's.
I know what you mean. You're saying if Trump shoots from the hip at 3 a.m. his tweets, will he shoot from the hip at 3 a.m. when he's got the nuclear codes and someone irritates him?
Which is like what my daughters, for instance, are afraid of.
I don't think, first of all, I don't know how Donald Trump will be president. Nobody knows. You can't say, well, he was this kind of mayor and that kind of governor, so he'll probably be this kind of president. He hasn't done those kind of public service roles, so I don't know. But I will say that nobody governs like the campaign. You say and do things in campaign mode, and then you, with the benefit of intelligence briefings and advisors and the understanding of the stakes of the game, you govern differently. And that doesn't make you a hypocrite. That just it makes you a leader.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I agree with you. In fact, I think probably every president in history has campaigned under different philosophies than they ultimately governed with. I mean, you go back to, there's a lot of campaign promises from both Obama and Bush before him where they almost did the opposite when they became president. But with Trump, it seems so calculated. Like, this was a very modern campaign. I mean, I think it's the only campaign I know of where the guy who spent less than his opponent won. I can't think of another campaign like that. I mean, he spent half of what Hillary spent.
Yeah, there have been other instances of people spending a lot less and winning when they're up against jillionaire candidates. But this was a really stark difference, which you don't usually get in presidential politics. It's usually pretty balanced. But Hillary spent about $625. Trump spent about $300. And then PAC supporting her spent three times as much as PAC supporting him. So if you're looking to how someone will run the thing, you got to look toward the, you know, cost per vote as some sort of efficiency measure. And on that score, he trounced her.
Well, again, where he was disciplined and where he ran a very different campaign from most people and the kind of what I would call the modern campaign of the 21st century, you had Jared Kushner, who owns the New York Observer. He essentially kind of spearheaded this idea of heavily targeting and polling via social media and then, you know, targeting much cheaper ads across social media to Trump or potential Trump supporters, and also to figure out what issues resonated most with potential Trump supporters. And I think, again, I wonder with this is sort of a different type of polling, you know, using social media to kind of figure out where your support is and what they stand for and so on. Did Trump do too much of this in order to basically say what he thought people wanted to hear so that he could win his votes?
Well, I mean, trying to win votes is sort of the job of any candidate. I don't think that's malpractice to try and get the most votes. That's kind of the point. But I think that the spending that Jared and Brad Parscale and some of the other guys on this team, evidence was pretty ingenious. I spent a long time doing politics for a living, and they broke a lot of the so-called rules, but they did it with a real strategy. So, for example, you talk about how they were buying cheaper online instead of television ads. They did spend a lot on television, and my former firm, Jamestown Associates, actually did 70% of the ads they did, but they did it in an unconventional way. For example, their sort of closing argument ad was a 2-minute spot. That's very expensive to buy, so they only bought it a lot. You know, you buy 2 minutes instead of 30-second spots. But that 2-minute spot became the most watched spot on YouTube of the entire campaign. It was clicked over 8 million times. So that was kind of a multiplier effect that those guys running the media of Donald Trump's campaign were able to perform. And as for polling, you know, I just think not nearly enough has been said about the way Clinton's campaign failed to see some of the trends that were happening. That she did not visit the state of Wisconsin a single time after the primary there is some sort of campaign malpractice. I mean, you saw how close it turned out to be, and you got to think she could have picked up 10,000-20,000 votes with a little more effort there. So I think it was a combination of Trump doing things very differently and doing things his own way, and Hillary Clinton's team simply relying on what they were reading in the New York Times and the Washington Post about her invincibility.
But what happened there behind the scenes? Like when you were on the podcast 2.5 years ago, you actually thought there was a chance Hillary might not run because of an unannounced illness. And of course, that became the rumor later on in the campaign, particularly after the conventions. What's the scoop? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, I got to brag a little bit. I listened to our podcast. I hate listening to myself.
I do too.
on old things. I will not watch myself because I seem to get fatter by the moment. But
not true. I think you're in excellent shape right now.
Thanks, James. You having bought me two or three milkshakes over the past year doesn't help. But even listening to myself is torture. But I will say that on that podcast, not only did I say that I thought her health would become an issue in this campaign, it was 2.5 years ago, but I said I would not be surprised if a far-left populist candidate capitalized on the discontent the nation was feeling and gave her a real hard time. Now, that's a great call. I mean, this was before Bernie Sanders was on anybody's radar. I'm very proud to have said that on your show.
Right.
I did not predict the incredible, stunning rise of Donald Trump, but I did feel that populism was in the air, and I said it on your program, and I'm real proud of that. So, you know, I don't know that the health issue that Hillary was clearly struggling with. I mean, you know, you'll remember right here in New York, she passed out and had to be helped to her feet,
right,
and cancel a bunch of events. So that wasn't just pure white right-wing crap. That was real. But I don't think that some of the discontent was about health per se. But I do think this feeling that she was tired and vulnerable and old fed into this right track, wrong track question. So to me, when I was in politics, I didn't pay too much attention to what's called the horse race number. This candidate's at 46, that candidate's at 42. I paid much more attention to two questions, which were, do you think we're on the right track or the wrong track? And do you prefer a strong leader or someone who shares your values? And those two questions pointed strongly to a win from a challenger. Hillary Clinton was, in the minds of the electorate, the incumbent. So when she started to look sort of exhausted and not show up in public and not talk to the press and then pass out, that fed into a narrative that we're tired of more of the same. Whereas Donald Trump, you know, throwing these giant rallies and shouting and screaming, getting his audience all riled up, that pointed to change. And this was there are sometimes when the electorate wants to stay the course and there's sometimes when they want change, and this electorate wanted change.
Well, and again, I've seen criticisms, which I think are unfair, of just like I saw criticisms of Hillary that I think were unfair, but I've seen criticisms where people say, okay, there was Trump the candidate, and now we're supposed to believe that Trump the president's going to be a lot different. And again, as you mentioned earlier, that almost every or probably every presidential candidate has been different after they become president. But how Trump was so targeted, depending on which group he was talking to, what he would say. Where do you think there's going to be the biggest disconnect between what he said before the election and what happens afterwards, given that we don't really know what's going to happen? But where do you see the potential biggest disconnects happening?
You know, I really couldn't say. I think in some ways he is going to do everything he said. I think we're already seeing that with regards to, for example, Russia, that, you know, Trump basically promised and said, what would be so wrong with having better relationships with Russia? And his reaction to this stunning news, to me, it's beyond the shadow of a doubt that Russia played a role in hacking the DNC. And his, you know, sort of, you know, so what reaction shows that he is going to follow through on this different kind of relationship with Russia. On the other hand, I think there has been a softening of some views with regards to immigration, for example. It went from, yeah, we're going to get all 13 million undocumented and round them up and ship them off, to more like, well, let's look at the ones with criminal records first. And that's obviously a much, much tinier sliver.
How do you do that? How do you look at the ones with criminal records? Because we don't really know what their records are in other countries.
Well, you know, I don't know how the Trump administration will pursue this policy. If you're asking my opinion about it, I think that's pretty easy. A lot of these so-called sanctuary cities, for example, we're sitting in one right this second, have asked people to sign up and say, you know, we'll protect you. And to me, that's outrageous. You can't say we're going to protect you from the reach of the top law enforcement officer of the United States, a constitutionally assigned enforcement branch of the United States. So if there are lawbreakers, you know, convicted, hopefully start with the felons, who have been given some sort of quasi-amnesty in sanctuary cities, then I think the federal government can apply all kinds of pressure to these cities to let them know who they are, and they ought to do that.
Like, what will happen? Like, let's take New York City, for instance. What could Trump do?
Well, I would hope that if there are felons who are here illegally, they would be deported and be sent back to wherever they came from.
And how do you define felon? Felon here or felon where they came from?
No, felon here.
Okay.
Someone who's committed a felony within the United States.
And isn't it, why weren't they deported before? Again, I'm asking naive questions, but if someone is illegally here and then committed a felony, why are they put in jail here and not just deported back to their country?
Well, James, you're actually touching on something that's not well known, because Barack Obama is so beloved by the people who usually get incensed about immigration matters that one of the little discussed facts is that Barack Obama has been very aggressive about deporting people here illegally, much more so than his two predecessors. So that's not something you'll hear all the time, but it happens to be the truth. But even given that, it's just an overwhelming task, and the federal government has decided to starve the authorities, the INS, responsible with it, from the resources they need to do it. And then it's also a depressing task, because literally sometimes you send these people home, they've done something horrible, in some cases served a jail sentence, serve their sentence, get sent back, and then days later are back in the country through this porous border. So it's not just one element. You can't just say, okay, we're just going to ship these people home if you have not enough security to keep them home or keep them out once they've been ejected.
So I feel I kind of want to hit a bunch of different issues, and everybody's got their issues that are important to them, and of course everyone has their beliefs, and they're not going to line up 100% with whoever's going to be president or whoever your favorite candidate is. But an issue that oddly is important to me is tariffs. And I sort of feel like a lot of small businesses that I talk to are really afraid of Trump putting high tariffs in China, because so many, like, let's say, I mean, we live here in New York, there's the garment district, so many small business owners who own clothing companies get their goods from China, and if it's too expensive, they're out of business, or costs go way up. It's not necessarily going to be linked to higher wages or more jobs for Americans if you put tariffs on Chinese goods, or any goods for that matter.
The Chinese are, this is an area where I completely agree with Donald Trump and disagree with you and your worried friends about the cost of goods. The Chinese have put millions and millions of Americans out of work. They've decimated the middle class, the manufacturing class of this country. And worse than that, they are chronic cheaters in every kind of way. It's not just the currency, which is universally, not just widely, but universally understood to be manipulated to their benefit, but it's in subtle ways. For example, I'm a very avid follower of Bitcoin, and the Chinese now have set up Bitcoin mining farms that are either subsidized by the government or, sort of wink and nod subsidized, so that their electricity costs are so low, not to mention that they're using the most polluting kinds of electricity. It's pure coal there. And 7/8 of the world's bitcoins that are being mined today are mined in China. This is a devastating scare to the people who, it's a small community, but it's a growing community that all you need is 51% of the mining, and you can shut down that market totally if you just decide you will not accept a trade. That the majority will not accept a trade, then the trade doesn't happen. This is very scary. So it's not just a government manipulating its own currency. It's that the government so supports industries that compete with others around the world that they quasi subsidize all kinds of industries. So I think your friends who don't want to pay more than 99 cents for a pair of socks ought to consider the Americans who have been put out of work by a country uses child labor, that has no environmental laws, that cheats constantly, that doesn't allow our goods access to their markets. And, maybe you'll have to pay for more for socks. And I'm sorry, James's friends, that's
okay,
just the price
of
their business.
Okay, but it's not just clothing. It's like technology. I mean, all computers come from, components made in China. Are you going to pay $2,500
for an iPhone? Why is that, James? Are those people in China just such harder workers than Americans? No, they're not. It's because they have an advantage supplied by virtually no environmental regulations, virtually no child labor law regulations. And, we have tons of trading partners who do follow essentially the same kind of rules. You know, nobody's proposing huge tariffs on Germany or Japan, or really, you know, even Mexico, other than the American companies that they go there. I'm talking about, you know, a giant company that one by one has closed down thousands and thousands of factories throughout the United States. And, you know, this kind of question in New York, when you say my friends who own pop-up stores, that doesn't reflect when you drive through these states that suddenly went for Trump, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. It doesn't reflect these abandoned cities that don't care how much they pay for socks at Walmart. They need to focus on their husband having a $22 job, the wife being able to move up through the ranks of a factory.
Is there evidence that tariffs being imposed do increase jobs in America? I mean, look, you have evidence of like, let's take in 1929, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which essentially caused the Great Depression. Like any kind of sort of government regulation on free trade, I'm afraid, doesn't necessarily lead to an increase in jobs for kind of the underclasses in the flyover states.
Right. Yeah, that's the libertarian viewpoint, and I accept it as a valid point of view, but what it doesn't account for is you're talking about a large tariff like Smoot-Hawley. What I'm eager to see is whether even the threat of a large tariff is enough to get a more level platform. And that's what we haven't had. We haven't had someone who would full-throatedly represent America's interests and unapologetically stand up for the American people and say, we're not going to take this. So, like, even in this Russian hacking that happened, if you read the brilliant Times article about it, detailing it, even the Democrats are begging Obama, say something, do something, give even a press conference like he did when North Korea hacked Sony. And the administration's response was, you know, sort of like it always is, cool, level-headed, don't play it up. And they just got bolder and bolder and went from fishing to actually publishing the stuff. It details it beautifully. And so I think this sort of lead-from-behind strategy we've seen over the Obama years has to come to an end. So
what,
I don't
do you
know
mean,
if tariffs
what do you mean
is
lead
the,
from behind, like because you know, on some cases, they've, you know, the Obama administration has taken a strong stance on, let's say, human rights, and in other cases, maybe not, like in these cyber hacking cases.
Well, if you think the Obama administration has taken a strong stance on human rights, I urge you to visit Aleppo right now, which has joined Srebrenica and Rwanda as sort of the infamous cities of total destruction. And that's exactly what I mean about lead from behind. Our position in Syria was, look, it's a mess. Every time we get involved in the Middle East, it gets screwed up worse. Let's just see how it happens. And what's unfolded is hundreds of thousands, nearing 300,000 killed, millions displaced in the greatest human rights disaster in the world because of our quote-unquote strategy to do nothing. And when you create a power vacuum, other people come in and do it. In this case, Russia, and now Assad, a great mass murderer, is going to emerge victorious. The rebels will have died. They'll have sent their displaced and angry and murderous people all over the world. And it's a total disaster. And so that's what I'm talking about leave from behind.
So Trump has expressed, both Trump and Bernie Sanders have expressed almost similar isolationist views. Like, why should America be the police of the world? Where do you think actually Trump is on this? And what do you think will happen?
You know, I really don't know. I think foreign policy is the area that is the most surprising. I mean, I believe when Obama was running, he had every intention of fulfilling his promise to close Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. I think that you know, fits his values, and I think he's a sincere guy and not a liar. And here we are 8 years later, and it's still open because I think what happens is you get in the office and you actually learn what the reality is rather than the ideal. So I think foreign policy is the single hardest area of a president to predict. So I don't know where Trump's going to fall out on these things.
Okay, so he just selected Rex Tillerson, the CEO of Exxon, to be Secretary of State, which is, like, Trump aside, is an interesting pick. Rex Tillerson obviously has never had foreign policy government experience, but he has immense foreign trade experience. And it kind of suggests that, okay, the U.S. is open for business in terms of working out, you know, favorable trade deals with other countries, favorable commerce deals with other countries, with Wilbur Ross as Secretary of Commerce. But it might. Where do you think things change when you put a businessman in that role as opposed to a diplomat in that role?
Yeah, you know, I think it remains to be seen. I don't know Rex Tillerson's record well enough to really give you an informed opinion, but I do think it's interesting that it reflects the Trump campaign's values. You know, basically he ran with this, look, I built this beautiful businesses. I built, businesses all over the world. I'm great at business. So he's someone who values that experience. He's not been shy about appointing billionaires who have accomplished a lot to these different posts. Obviously, he holds the belief that to do what they've done took some skill, and to, that hopefully that skill translates into skill in government. I don't know that that's always been the case in past administrations, but I'm willing to give this a shot. A company like Exxon, it almost runs as its own country. Their revenue is about the same as the GDP of South Africa. So, I mean, it's this giant, sprawling, complex enterprise with business all over the world. You know, there'll be a lot of questions raised. I think in the Senate, he'll get a hard time because he's been close to Putin, and that's become very in vogue. And these sort of couple key Republicans like John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who love to see themselves lauded in the New York Times, will give him a hard time about that relationship. But I doubt it'll be fatal to his candidacy, because I think that you can't build a company like Exxon without knowing what you're doing.
Yeah, and also to give Exxon some credit, they do a lot of research on green energy, alternative energies, and so on. Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Let me ask you about Secretary of Treasury, ex Goldman Sachs guy Steven. I don't know how to say his last name.
Mnuchin.
It's basically the third or fourth Goldman Sachs guy in recent decades to hold the position. Is this business as usual in the Treasury Department?
You know, I think that there is a case to be made for that. Goldman Sachs has been this feeder, the sort of farm team for the presidents of both parties, in a way that is definitely off-putting to a lot of Americans who see it as sort of a shadowy company. But Goldman Sachs is sort of the best investment bank we have and has produced a lot of the best talent we have. So Trump's promise was to go get good people, and Mnuchin's a very smart guy and very well qualified to do this. And then, of course, he also, you know, is that guy who bet on Trump early, full forcedly, when few others were willing to. And that's how loyalty is built in cabinets.
Well, do you think, speaking of loyalty, I think, again, he was considering Mitt Romney for Secretary of State, and Mitt Romney's somebody who Trump supported early on in 2012, and then Romney, of course, did not support him in this election. Do you think he was just sort of playing with Romney, or was he considering him? Is he still considering him for something?
I don't know. I don't have any insider insight into that. I thought, my own personal opinion is that Mitt Romney was way out of bounds in his criticism, and was obnoxiously doing it in a way to restore personal relevance, which is not what a party guy does. You know, his niece has just gotten a major position, the head of the RNC. She's very talented. She's been the head of the Michigan GOP in its resurgent year. That box has kind of been checked already, but I personally thought Mitt was way out of bounds with his take, you know, not going to the convention, being just searing in his criticism, calling him a phony and all that. I just don't get it. I think it's perfectly valid to disagree with Trump. I thought, former President Bush, both former presidents Bush, handled that same point of view in a much more dignified way. Look, if Donald Trump thought Mitt Romney would be the best Secretary of State, I bet he would have appointed him, because he's all about winning and success, and he seems to recover very easily from personal slights, as we've seen with other picks. But I thought Mitt was way out of bounds.
Do you think there's any chance he's going to reach across the aisles and appoint a Democrat to any major positions?
I don't know. You know, that's sort of a tradition, right? You usually get, Secretary of Transportation or one of these somewhat politically neutral
or even with
offices.
Bill Clinton, chief of staff, with Gergen,
yeah,
was across the aisles.
Well, Clinton, and also having Morris in there, Clinton was a special case, because he was, he won as a triangulator. Nobody nobody considered that a sellout because his whole appeal was, you know, that Democratic Leadership Council and, you know, being a guy centrist. So it's not quite the same. It's more surprising when Obama occasionally did it and when George W. Bush occasionally did it, and both of them did. So far, we haven't seen any inclination of that from Donald Trump. But look, the guy spent most of his life giving, you know, at least equally, if not predominantly, to Democrats. He has longstanding relationships, and it's odd to run for president against someone to whom you've been a prolific donor. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if a few Democrats found their way into this administration.
Where so far, you know, given your early and avid support of him, where so far has he disappointed you?
Even though
it's early in the game to
say. Yeah, I mean, I'm not disappointed at all with anything he's done since being elected. I think he's putting together a great cabinet. I approve of all of these selections. I think he knows what he's doing. I will tell you, just to smash the notion that I'm somehow unwilling or unable to criticize Donald Trump, that of all of the scandals that he had during the campaign, most of them I didn't think were anything at all. The one that disappointed me most was when he suggested that the judge in the Trump University case couldn't hear the case fairly because of his Mexican heritage. I thought that was a unfair and maybe even dangerous point of view. And I hope given some time and you know, greater exposure to the judicial process, that he's reconsidered that.
But you know, that has led to the whole cry of, you know, racism, because it's not only do you see people who are supporting, or many of Trump's supporters are kind of known racists, and I agree with the point that just because they support you doesn't mean you support them back, but then you have Trump giving that clue, in this case, that the Mexican judge, that he might feel the same way. That is somewhat disturbing.
Yeah, that's exactly why it disturbed me. Look, I know Donald Trump. He's not a racist. He's just not. I wouldn't support him if he was, but beyond that, you know, if you know him, you just know that he's not, in a way that's very hard to spell out in a way to people who don't know him. You kind of know among your friends and among the people you know who secretly harbors hatred in their heart, and he doesn't. So I'm not worried about him being a racist at all, but I thought that particular take on the judge was just wrong. It's not the American way. It's not how we evaluate people.
Well, why do you think? And I'm gonna call this the media. But why do you think there are so many calls that Trump is an anti-Semite? Given, I mean, he's, you know, Jared Kushner's Orthodox Jewish. His grandchildren are Orthodox Jews. Why are people? I actually, again, naive question. Maybe I'm missing something. Where is the anti-Semitism?
There isn't any. Where's the charge coming from? It comes from because people are full of shit. There is no anti-Semitism there. Look, I've seen this guy twice hold his grandson at a bris. You know, it's just ridiculous, and it's dangerous to call everybody an anti-Semite all the time, and it's dangerous to call people racist all the time, because there are actual anti-Semites in the world. There are actual racists, and you know, in a boy cried wolf situation like this, it deadens the sensibilities of a great democracy here. And we can't just scream every time somebody uses, oh, that star had this many points on it, not that many. That's ridiculous. You know, this topic incenses me, James. For a year, in 2014, I wrote every week, to the irritation, I'm sure, of my bosses, I wrote editorials decrying the Iran deal and saying this is an existential threat to the Jewish homeland, to the majority of the world's Jewish population. And nobody gave a shit at all. Nobody cared. I couldn't get people interested. I won Jewish Journalist of the Year for that, and yet real people couldn't care less, including all these people who are outraged because this star has this many points, or because this guy who ran a website who published one article that said one thing gets to be in the administration. It's ridiculous. I pay almost no attention to these little minor things. You know, I'm 48 years old. Since I'm a little kid, every time there's a swastika painted on a tombstone in a Jewish cemetery or something, I expect the brown shirts to like bust through my door any second. That's how I'm built. That's who I am. So this stuff, these little minor things, where idiots basically act like idiots, that's been happening forever, literally since the history of the Jewish people. What's new in this world is stuff like Iran becoming a nuclear power. And that's where I expect a strong leader like Donald Trump, who criticized that deal more ferociously than anybody, that's where I expect him to do some good in the world.
So explain what was wrong with that deal to me. Just again, on the surface, okay, we're going to release some sanctions and they're going to get rid of 98% of their nuclear material. What's the bad part?
This is so frustrating to me because
if I'm saying this, that means most people don't know what the bad part is.
It's so painful to me because it's a done deal. You know, now Boeing's going to sell $40 billion worth of planes to them, and people talk about don't normalize Donald Trump. I'm saying don't normalize Iran, which is currently today. This isn't some theory about what it's going to do. They brutally put down the opposite political party. I mean, with murder. Mm-hmm. They're the Globe's leading sponsor of state-sponsored terrorism. They funded the Assad regime. I mean, this is they're currently right now today threatening Israel through their proxies in Hezbollah and Hamas. So this isn't like a theoretical threat. This is a real threat that is actually killing real people and making a dangerous region an impossibly dangerous region.
But was there a danger that with the nuclear material they had that they could have developed?
Yes, absolutely. But the right question isn't to say, okay, let's let you continue to develop and stall it by 10 years. The right answer is to say, we've got you trapped. You're at your own 2-yard line. And, it's 4th and 25, and we just gave you a first down. So now you're at the 35-yard line instead of the 2. And I hate to use sports analogies because it trivializes a very desperate situation. But the fact is, Iran was this close. And again, listeners, I'm holding my forefinger and thumb very close to one another in what Tom Wolfe would describe as the universal gesture of being very close. So Iran was this close to being suffocated and finally getting its people who are very well educated and are readers. And
it's a
secular population with a great history of science and art and math. They were this close to being able to stage an actual revolution. And that's what I'm talking about with Obama leading from behind. When he had the chance to support an actual revolution for the good guys, he passed. It wasn't until Egypt, when the good guys were revolting, that he said, no, not so fast. Let's support the Muslim Brotherhood. And I just can't understand this whole lead from behind strategy that results in the Iran deal, that results in doing nothing in Syria, that results in opposing the people in Egypt who were reasonable and have proven themselves now. Thank God they won and are proving themselves to be running a pretty realistic, forward-looking country.
Now, in terms of this lead from behind versus lead from the front, let's say Trump's a lead from the front type of guy, but he's also said, listen, if we're going to go out there in the world and bring our military, other NATO countries have to foot the bill as well. What if the other countries don't foot the bill? Are we just going to stay home? Or again, I'm actually pretty isolationist myself, but that's not usually how it works out in practice.
Well, that's like your China question. I think what we've got in Donald Trump is someone who, like Ronald Reagan, when Gorbachev looked in his eyes, he famously said, I knew he meant it. And I think that's what you've got with Donald Trump, that what we've had now is just the other countries go, well, I won't honor my commitment to put 2% of my GDP into defense. We'll just have America cover the balance. And when Trump says, we're not going to do that anymore, I think they believe it. So I don't think we're going to get to a point where we won't protect, a NATO ally from an invasion. I think what will start to happen is these other countries will start ponying up the money that they've committed to for 70 years now.
Or what if China calls one of these countries and says, hey, we'll start supporting your military and we'll start doing deals with you. Like, is there any kind of resetting of the chips happening around the world if we kind of pull out of supporting certain countries?
Yeah, I think there will be a realignment, but you see that with every president. We're closer to some and less close to others. I mean, I never thought we'd see, Cuba become virtually an ally of the United States during my lifetime. And that's, in my view, a success of the Obama administration. So you see realignments constantly as the world changes.
I mean, it's hard to say, though. This is my point always, and I'm curious your opinion on it. What effect is that of Obama, or just the fact that Castro basically got so old he couldn't lead the country and now he's dead? And, just the world changing in due course anyway, regardless of who's president.
That's exactly right, James. It's I think Winston Churchill joked that the the one thing you can't plan for in politics is the news. And that changes things. Fidel Castro was in his 90s, so it was inevitable that he was going to die. But there could have been an even stronger strong man instead of his brother, who is more sort of Western friendly. There could have been, who knows, who could have come in there. So you can't plan for everything, but we do our best to elect someone who will represent most of American interests mostly well.
So we were talking before the podcast started, and again, I'm largely apolitical, but I see it on both sides of my Facebook feed. It's just like a shitstorm out there. Everyone's angry. Everyone's yelling at each other. Everyone's defriending each other. This particular race seemed to be more divisive than even the Bush-Gore 2000. Like, I've never seen anything like this. It's been kind of insane. Just, you can't even talk to people one way or the other.
Yeah, it's a really troubling phenomenon of this race. I don't know, I'm a student of American history, and looking back to when these guys like actually shot each other sometimes, go out to Weehawken and have a duel. I don't know that it is truly the most divisive in American history, but it's right up there, and it is a shame. And the social media phenomenon to which you allude is real. I try very hard on my own. I'm not on Twitter, and that's on purpose because it's just so angry and so nasty. And on Facebook, where you at least have better control over who you communicate with, I try really hard not to get into politics.
But it's all very smart people on both sides. Like, what is the main argument? Again, he's elected, so now I don't say it's an obligation to let's see what happens and let him take his best shot. But like, why aren't people on either side willing to say, hey, let's all figure out how unity can happen here?
Yeah, I'm not sure why that is. I think we're really waiting for a sort of a great uniter type, either candidate like a Reagan or incident like a September 11th, because I just don't see how we're going to get together and act as one. Like, already, the guy's he's 30 days from being sworn in, and Paul Krugman, who cried and whined like a little bitch for months about whether Donald Trump was going to accept the results of the election, now he's already calling Donald Trump the illegitimate president. And you've got, websites like the Daily Beast that have just decided that every single day they're just going to pound him with every single article. And it just, to me, it's like there's no chance for us to even start on the same page. I mean, even Barack Obama, who was elected amid some very nasty campaigning, both in his primary and then in the general in 2008, at least he started amid a true crisis, a financial crisis. And I think there was a lot of hope, even among people who didn't vote for him, that this transformative president who was younger and didn't look like other presidents was going to do things differently. That dissipated fairly quickly when Obamacare became such a divisive issue. But Trump doesn't even seem to be getting that, sort of six-month honeymoon, and it's disappointing.
So, okay, you mentioned Obamacare. I forgot to ask about that. What's going to happen to Obamacare?
Well, I hope it's dismantled.
Trump's already alluded he's not going to totally dismantle.
That's right. I think there's a lot of this, we'll keep the good parts, but the problem with that is that the reason those good parts weren't in there in the first place is they had to be in there as sweeteners to pay for this incredibly unaffordable, gigantic, sprawling, and now failing bureaucracy. I mean, people are just starting to get their health bills for coverage and are realizing that this is totally unsustainable. You can't have 15, 20% average increases with some as high as 30 and 40%. Obviously, after a year or two, that's unsustainable. So the whole premise of Obamacare that young, healthy people are going to sign up and pay voluntarily, that never seemed realistic to me. That seemed like a typical idealistic just notion that wasn't based in reality. I mean, you stand on any corner and watch people smoke and do like what I do is, eat disgusting things and have milkshakes, and people don't take care of their best interests. They're just not rational in that way. So this assumption that they would suddenly say, oh, I barely have $300 in my pocket, why don't I just spend it on healthcare when I feel super healthy and feel like I'm going to live forever? It wasn't ever realistic.
So, but you do see now, since the election, a sharp rise in signups for Obamacare because people are worried that it'll be dismantled before they get a chance to get their year of cheaper health insurance.
know, well, it's not going to be dismantled overnight. That's mm-hmm. not possible. And, you know, I thought Trump was actually quite merciful during the Republican primaries when everybody was racing to say how fast they take it apart. He was the one who took the sort of more centrist position of saying we don't want people sick in the streets. No one wants that. And that's just not sustainable for any president. It's not going to be dismantled overnight. But Obamacare is by my lights, a totally failing system. It needs to be either replaced by a free market system, which is essentially what we had, but with, you know, without these crazy, you know, state by state regulations. You know, let the free market handle it, or a single payer system like you know, like Canada has, which I would despise even more than Obamacare. But this middle ground is clearly failing.
So. Before the podcast started, we were talking about what's going on with the New York Observer. You're one of the first. I mean, I've loved the New York Observer ever since I moved to New York City in 1994. It was this big pink paper I would just spread out on like a diner table and read it. Now, the print version you guys have recently announced is dead. It's digital only. How's it going?
It's going great. We had about seven times the traffic in the last month of the existence of the print New York Observer. We had seven times the online traffic as we did in the first month that I got here. We went from 3 million page views to 20. We went from the 3,600th biggest website in the country to 275th. So, you know, my job, my goal in life is to deliver great writing and thoughtful ideas and strong points of view through whichever medium people want it, and they're voting with their feet. You know, people were not reading the paper edition, and they're reading the website like crazy. So that's where we're going to reach them. This is obviously it's so obvious that this is a conversation that every single newspaper in the country is going to have. The Wall Street Journal just killed its Metro section. The Daily News looks like a comic book at this point. It's so small.
You know, big financial magazines like Forbes are about half the size that they used to be.
That's exactly, and that's in boom times. You know, that's what the Dow was soaring. You remember during internet, the first internet boom in 1999, there was whole magazines invented, and they looked like phone books, like Industry Standard and Red Herring.
Yeah,
just to accommodate all the print ads. Now we're in sort of another boom, at least the stock market boom, and you know, nobody needs that. Nobody needs that print delivery vehicle because that's not where people are consuming it. So look, I'm old fashioned myself. I would have loved it if our consumers kept buying that print New York Observer every week, but they weren't. So I'm not gonna you know continue to. I want to spread our resources on great journalism and deliver that journalism however people want it, not just like, oh, it's, I've decided we're printing, you know, we're printing on a stone tablet, so everyone has to get a stone tablet. That's just not how it goes.
So, again, just real briefly back to Trump, you know, one of the main things I guess people are worried about are judges. So, you know, he's got a Supreme Court justice to appoint. I know he's looking at something like 20 plus potential, you know, candidates for this. Do you think Trump is serious about his kind of pro-life, anti-gay marriage stance, or do you think that might have just been campaign talk, or where do you think we go there?
Well, I think that he was actually on the gay marriage thing. I think he was pretty clear in saying that's a settled decision. It was settled by the Supreme Court and doesn't need to be revisited. So I'll take exception with your characterization.
All right, you're right. And actually, he repeated that on 60 Minutes. He said that's a done deal. I'm not going to touch it.
Yeah, with pro-life, yeah, I think he's serious about it. I think he'll appoint pro-life judges. That's an incredibly important issue to this giant section of the people who got him elected. I don't think it's a negotiable issue. And I think that's, you know, he took the very unusual step of releasing a list of people he'd consider. And that list was widely considered very thoughtful and very strong, even by conservatives like Paul Ryan, who often criticized Donald Trump. So I'd be very surprised if, you know, some sort of Stevens type guy, you know, sort of strolls his way in and makes it who wasn't on that list.
Do you think Trump and Paul Ryan will continue having a good relationship? You think he'll have a good relationship overall with Congress?
Well, I think Donald Trump is a guy who's proven throughout his business career that he's more about getting the job done than about you know, nursing these grudges to the grave. I think that the characterization of him is just so strange. The Mitt Romney one you brought up is a good example. And Rick Perry's just been appointed to Energy Secretary. Perry was very critical of Trump. He's sort of shown that he's going to put people in place who he thinks will do the job, you know, rather than you know, keep these grudge battles alive. So I hope that his relationship with Speaker Ryan is strong. That's very important. And even in bipartisan times, I mean, the Tip O'Neill Ronald Reagan relationship was key to a lot of things that just about everybody agrees were great about the 1980s. So
I think though some Republicans might be angling towards 2020, where they see, okay, we're going to give Trump a few months potentially to see if he can start executing things. Else, we're going to start gunning for him, putting him down, and then we're putting ourselves in place for 2020. And I could see Paul Ryan taking that stance.
You think that they'd run for president against incumbent? That's far-fetched. I mean, that's happened on occasion, but it's always with an insurgent candidate like a Ronald Reagan against a Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford hadn't been elected. He had been vice president. Ronald Reagan wasn't
Ted Kennedy versus office. Jimmy Carter in 1980.
That's the Democrats. That's a different, you know, the Republicans have this very orderly, you know, wait in line type of way to do things. It's something that have to go seriously, seriously wrong with the Trump presidency, which is possible for that to happen. But if it went so wrong, it's just almost impossible to picture the Republican winning in that situation. So I don't know that it'd be, you know, real desperation to have that nomination.
Okay, so prediction. You made a prediction in 2 years ago. What's your prediction for the Democrats 4 years from now? Who's in line?
You know, I can't talk about 4 years from now because you got to look at the midterms. It's very hard for an incumbent president to hold on to a majority if he's got it when he comes in. So the Democrats ought to be looking to 18 as their big chance to put some pain on the Republican Party. That's why it was so baffling to me that they, you know, their leaders of the party are the same. I couldn't believe that Nancy Pelosi won. I mean, how does she win? This is a year they should have had major pickups. You know, Charles Schumer will be an effective minority leader in the Senate, but he's a get-along guy. All of the energy in the Democratic Party is in the sort of the Bernie Sanders wing, and none of those people seem to have been rewarded at the DNC, at the in Congress, in the Senate, and even to have Joe Biden still talking about himself as presidential candidate for 20, it's stunning to me. I mean, it's unbelievable to me that the whole energy of the wing, the whole insurgent side of the Democratic Party has to come from a 72-year-old in the first place. You know, where's their next Barack Obama? Where's that guy?
Okay, I'll throw out a name. Like, what about Cory Booker in Newark?
I don't think Cory Booker was a good mayor of Newark, I don't know what record he's got to run on. In his defense, as a senator, it's very tough in the minority in the Senate to get much done. So the fact that he has zero signature legislation is kind of not his fault, because few minority senators, and I mean minority party, not minority race, you know, can ever really break through the noise. That's just the way the Senate is set up. But Cory Booker is a great speaker, a great orator. But you got to have something more than that to run on. And you look at the state of Newark, which I spend time in a couple times a week, and it's actually now finally under its new mayor on the upswing a little bit. But
why is it so much time in Newark?
I have my kids half the time, James, if you must know, and your listeners are super interested in my personal life. I have my kids half the time, and when I'm not in New York, I have a place in New Jersey, so I can try and raise them a little bit. And today is my son's 15th birthday. I should throw that out there. This won't air on the same day we're recording it, but I do want to note it.
Well, I will let you get to your son's birthday. And one final question. Donald Trump calls you today and says, Ken, you've been such a great supporter. I trust your advice. I want you to be ambassador to India or something. Do you say yes?
You know, if the president calls you, you can't easily turn him down. The truth is, I have been discussed for various roles.
Like what?
And I prefer not to say. But I've got my dream job. I love what I'm doing. I take it seriously. I love what we're building at The Observer. You can't kind of play both sides. I'm flattered to be considered, It's nice to be thought of that way. But, you know, barring a call from the president-elect himself saying that your country needs you, suit up, I'm happy where I am.
Well, thanks, Ken, once again for coming on the podcast. Super appreciate it, and gave me a lot of insightful information. And so I hope listeners appreciate it as well.
James, what a treat to see you always.
Next time on the James Altucher Show.
My happiness and my quality of life is much more important than cashing out some money on a business. I didn't care anymore. I wanted to be happy again.
But, you know, most people wouldn't have the confidence to say, okay, I'm also going to do something I never did before, which is travel around the world. And at the same time, I'll be able to make a living.
Americans don't understand how insanely expensive it is to live in the U.S. I did the math on this.
I'm kind of depressed listening to this. So why? Give me another excuse. Why don't people do this? I mean, I'm getting ready. I feel like packing myself right now.